This is the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast.
Raise your hand if you had it on your college football bingo card that this would be the year that the entire college football community would be rocked by the Ivy League. And that's what we're seeing live and in person. Golic and Wingo on ESPN Radio, ESPN News. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike Golic, sitting with Mike Golic Jr. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. All guests appear on the show. Penzo, Performance Line, Mike. Obviously, all eyes yesterday were going to be on the Ivy League, trying to figure out what they decide as a conference they're comfortable with as far as playing any sports, and we get the answer of that. We thought that there might be postponement. They might try and find a way to play games. No, in fact, the college football season is gone for the Ivy League. Canceled is the key word. There will not be college football from the Ivy League, and while it's a small domino, it is the first domino we've seen actually fall in the answer of what will happen for college football.
I was saying, we will focus on football, but this is for all fall sports. The Ivies have announced they are ruling out playing all fall sports. They're the first Division I conference to do so because of the coronavirus pandemic. No decision made yet about winter or spring sports in Ivy or whether fall sports could be played in the spring of 2021, but it sounds like for football, you mentioned that word canceled is the one that's coming up, meaning that is gone in this situation. So, I know this is one that on the outside looking in, people are going to look at and say, you know what, it is, you know, it's the Ivy Leagues. It's not the money makers in college football. It's all these things, but it's one of the first important data points that we've gotten in this conversation as it pertains to what's coming up in the fall as we creep closer and closer to Power 5 college football, the rest of these sports having to make some uncomfortable decisions, some of which we're already seeing pop up in the world of big-time Power 5 sports.
Well, let's look at where this decision came from. Robin Harris, the executive director of the Ivy League, was on Spain & Company last night and talked about where this decision came from and where the protocol was justified.
So what the presidents wanted to do was decide what needed to be decided right now. And it's similar to the approaches most of them have taken regarding campus policies, that the campus policies are subject to change based on how the virus changes and how our ability to treat or combat the virus changes. So as campus policies change, then we can modify what's happening in athletics. So if the situation gets better, that will allow more athletic activities and hopefully competition to occur. And conversely, if it were to get worse, then, you know, we might have to go the other way.
She mentioned that a good number of the Ivy League schools have placed restriction on travel for faculty, staff, and students, which includes the athletes and the coaches involved in this. And some also have restrictions for visitors. So all of those would affect the ability to go around and have athletic competition during all of that. And so in this case, and especially at the Ivies, we know the campus side is always going to dictate to the athletic side. That's the dynamic there. And so with all of that in mind, they couldn't go forward with this.
Well, and let's be real about what's at stake in some of these conversations. Myra Metcalf pointed out yesterday on Twitter, you know, when you talk about Harvard and Yale and Princeton, you're talking about schools that combine to get about $11 million each in generated revenue from college football. That's a stark difference from the close to $150 million that Ohio State generates. So let's be real about how these decisions are being made. We'd be lying to the world to say that money isn't a driving factor in it. Money, obviously, a much different conversation for the Ivy League schools than it is for the Power 5 schools as they try and figure out how they're going to move forward.
And I think this is the perfect thing to underscore what we're hearing in a lot of the rest of college football is, well, we got to do this. Jim Harbaugh came out yesterday, Michigan's head football coach, and one of the things you heard him say was, I'm paraphrasing some, but I'm pretty sure the phrase is, we got to do this. He said, COVID-19 is part of our society. It's not something that was caused by sports or will be made worse by sports, which I don't think is a claim that he can back up when it comes to can be made worse by in all of this, because it depends on what your then floating definition of worse is. But got to play. The Ivy showed you, we don't got to do anything intrinsically, not for the reasons that people are going to bring up, because they've worked so hard to get to this point, because athletics are important to them. No, this is a dollars and cents type thing. We got to do this because, as we're seeing out on the West Coast with Stanford right now, there are athletic departments all around the Power Five that have been punching up, that have been trying to overextend themselves and write checks that it only looks like they can cash based on the strength of Power Five football in a lot of senses. And we're seeing, and I'd sadly imagine going to see more examples of that not being the case.
Well, and for me, I've gone back and forth on this issue so many times. Will there be college football? I get asked all the time, are we going to have college football in the fall? And if you'd asked me a few months ago, I said squarely, no, I didn't think it was going to be safe. And then the economics article came out on ESPN.com that sort of broke down some of the money issues and the roughly $65 million lost per school and the fact that less than half of all of the FBS schools across the country have reserves to handle those sorts of losses. And that shook me when I read it. I mean, there was this moment when I stepped back and I thought, wow, I mean, should we have college football? No, I don't think we should. Will we have college football? I don't understand how the sport sustains. I don't understand how college athletics sustain economically without college football. So when Harbaugh says we have to have it, you're right. I just want transparency in that. Like, don't try and make it like you're altruistic and you're suddenly the beacon of light in a dark, dark world for giving us college football. We got to have it because if we don't have college football this year, I don't know who bails out college sports, but somebody will have to.
Bobby Carpenter, our ESPN NFL analyst, was actually on Freddie and Fitzsimmons, former Ohio State great, and brought up what happens if we have no football.
College athletics is a single-income family, and football is that single income. And, you know, talking to some people at Ohio State and going through it, I mean, football accounts for really $150 to $160 million, really the entire budget. So you wipe that out. There's not going to be any sports the rest of the year. Like, and that just isn't Ohio State. Ohio State's similar to Stanford. They had 36 varsity sports. And so if you eliminate that, like, there's not going to be any sports the rest of the year. And if that's happening at places like Ohio State and Stanford, it's going to be happening definitely at places that aren't as financially solvent as some of these big Power Five schools.
Golic and Wingo here on ESPN Radio, Mike Golic Jr. and Jason Fitz. Stanford, that he mentions there, and we've mentioned a couple times, it's worth noting, announced yesterday that it was going to cut 11 varsity sports, citing the pandemic as a breaking point. They had one of the largest athletic departments, 36 varsity sports, on their payroll and all this, and said, quote, "After considering the effects of this model, we determined that our operating varsity athletic programs in this manner would be antithetical to Stanford's values and our determination to be excellent in all that we do." Now, they're going to still honor the scholarships of all the athletes, honor the contracts of all the coaches, but a school with a $23 plus billion endowment is doing all of this. And that's what people are looking at and going, oh, bleep, we might see more of this.
Well, and again, I'll go back to the article that ESPN.com had that Schlabaugh wrote, that quoted a survey that said, right now, according to a survey of more than 100 athletic directors, only 41% of Power Five schools and 26% of Group of Five schools have reserves that will allow them to stay in business without any sort of college football revenue. So you start thinking about that. I mean, that's why this is a landscape changing decision in my mind with the Ivy League. That being said, Greg Sankey, SEC commissioner, made it clear on Freddie and Fitzsimmons last night that the Ivy League is not the SEC.
I don't think that the announcement today is any inflection point for decision making. Now, when you look at what's happening from the trend line with virus testing, with hospitalizations, with supplies and treatments, those are the real inflection points for us.
Which this is in response to, so it is something to keep an eye on here. And we'll get to more comments from Greg Sankey later, where he even addresses the idea of the spring football season in a way that should remind you, if Power Five commissioners are already reckoning with and potentially discussing behind closed doors the things that it would take to get there, it's a much more real option than we've all made it out to be in recent weeks.
That's an interesting point and something I talked to Heather Dinich about a little bit yesterday on First Take Your Take. You know, the NFL doesn't seem to want to play nice right now to moving the draft. And if they don't want to play nice to moving the draft, how does that affect college football moving into the spring? And Heather seems to think that it has a high effect on it, that they want partnership with the NFL if they're going to move that. There are so many complications. I'm not saying it can't happen, but the concept of moving it to spring, there are so many complications to it. I thought Harvard would be the one, or the Ivy League, I should say, would be the ones that opened that door. I expected to get an announcement that they were looking at postponement. The fact that the word cancel sits in the football portion of it was what surprised me, because to me, I thought spring was the real option.
And I think there's a pros and cons list we can do for this that kind of underscores the very clear things at stake and the very clear benefits, because despite all the complications, when we look at this, the financials that are going to make this decision may actually be better served in the spring.
Look at that. Mike Olick Jr. going to break it down. He'll figure out. We've got a lot to break down on this. Obviously, a lot to get to. But coming up, a double down and then an apology. What is Steven Jackson doing? It's an ever turning. It's like as the world turns there. That's next. But first.
Golic.
Golic and Wingo.
And Wingo.
Mm-hmm. Trey Wingo and Mike Golic Sr. And so I have to ask, we're excited to welcome in Taylor Twellman, our ESPN soccer analyst on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Taylor, the only gripe I have is the name of the tournament, the MLS's back tournament. We couldn't come up with something slightly more original.
Oh, boy, Junior. I thought the only problem you had was my mug being all over your screen yesterday. Usually that's a problem for you and I. I don't know. I mean, we could have named it a million things because it's 2020, and honestly, anything flies right now, which is kind of part of there. So MLS is back as a tongue twister. I'm calling it the tournament. I'm staying with the tournament, and that's what I'm doing because what else am I going to – MLS is back. Say that five times fast. It's almost as bad as Toy Boat.
I mean –
It's a great point.
Twellman, I got to ask. Like, there are days that I just walk in the room – and I look at my hair, and I'm like, you know what? It's going to be a good show today because my hair looks good. When your hair always looks as good as yours does, like, is there a factor for, like, I mean, because you're right. Your face was all over TV yesterday, and I just kept thinking, that guy, he's got it all, Twellman. Like, I'm not sure how to even feel about it anymore.
It's hard. It's not easy. It's extremely difficult. And for all the listeners and viewers at home, I want your sympathy. You know, when you wake up and look in the mirror and you're like, wow, I really don't need to do anything today. That's a good feeling. Now, it's not as good as the thigh meat that Junior's been bringing over the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 months during this pandemic, but it's pretty close.
Well, no, I don't know that anything tops the thigh. I'm surrounded by too much beauty for a man of my stature. So let's ask you some real questions here as we take a look at MLS returning. All eyes from all leagues are going to be on this return. So what do you think other leagues right now can learn from the way the MLS is handling this?
Well, the NBA is 100% looking at this with bifocals on, with a magnifying glass, just the bubble, right? And the one thing that has stood out to me, you guys, is that this. Every state has treated the COVID-19 pandemic differently. And so that includes in your home market testing, quarantines, and what we've seen with FC Dallas and Nashville. If you take those two teams out of the bubble, 634 players have been tested. One was positive. 3 days later, that was a false positive. So it really was and is comes down to FC Dallas, the Dallas market, and the Nashville market. And so the leagues have to be extremely careful. And the NBA is looking at this because when you bring the athletes in, you are going to see positives. That's not the issue. The issue is your bubble secure enough to let them stay in quarantine, stay away from everybody else that has arrived, so the others can prosper? Because that is an unbelievable ratio, gentlemen, that if you've got 634 players and it's now at zero positive, then you could actually put on this tournament for a month. But if each individual market is treating it this way, then Fitz, that's the kind of conversation we're going to have. And the NBA is going to look at that. Major League Baseball is a completely different situation because they're going into home markets to play games. The NHL is looking at this, obviously, with their situations in the bubbles and whatnot. But I think it's opened up a lot of eyes that, you know what, you've got 48 states mainland, and it's not easy because, as a whole, we've done everything regarding our local markets differently. And so when you come into a bubble, you're almost dealing with each individual state and those teams with how they've handled the pandemic.
Taylor Twellman with us, our ESPN soccer analyst here on Golic and Wingo. And Taylor, looking at the on-the-field portion, because that was one of the other things that we talked about in regards to the NFL yesterday, was concern by the players of the chance of injury increasing when they've come back, how long it's going to take guys to get into shape. So from what you saw last night, we had Orlando City beating Inter Miami 2-1 last night. What did you see on the field, and what have you felt like has been the reaction so far to a return to play after such a long layoff?
Good question, Mike, because I think so many people were watching the Bundesliga, England, La Liga, Serie A, and you got to remember, those leagues are finishing their seasons. This league is starting their season again, and what I mean by that is 6 of the last 8 months, majority of these players have not been playing games, and so injuries is a huge part of this. Now, what's changed, and rightfully so, and anyone says that it's a gimmick, it's not. You have hydration breaks, which if the weather's hot enough, that's already been in there, but now these are mandatory. But more importantly, five substitutions per team. And that's the most important thing there. And the one thing I noticed on the field, to answer your question, is I didn't know what it's going to look like, but I think there's going to be a trend. You're going to see a ton of goals scored after the 60th minute. And the reason why is when you only have three subs in a typical professional soccer game, Mike and Fitz, that only allows a coach three times to change a game. Now you've got a hydration break, which is a built-in timeout, and you've got, yes, those three instances to make changes, but you can make five substitutions. So you can completely change a game. Not every player's fit for 90 minutes. They're not expected to be. So the game's going to open up, and that's exactly why you saw Orlando City, Miami turn it up, I think, and be a little bit more open and expansive and entertaining in the last 25 to 35 minutes.
We're talking to ESPN soccer analyst Taylor Twellman on the Shell Penzo Performance Line. Golic and Wingo, Jason Fitz in for Trey. Mike, you just mentioned those changes and the benefits. Any chance that they become permanent fixtures in the way MLS plays?
No, absolutely not. This is simply a FIFA way to look at it, and they are 100% correct in looking at it, Fitz, of just saying we need to accommodate the players and the technical staffs and the coaches when you're trying to play X number of games in a short amount of time, and also allow these players to play themselves into fitness. So this will not be a permanent thing. Hydration breaks there, right? That was there for the last World Cup. That depends on, you know, a temperature reading and the humidity and all that. I'm not a meteorologist, so I'll stay away from that. But the five substitutions, that's temporary. That will not be permanent.
Taylor, the other thing that we saw last night that I think we can expect to be, maybe if not permanent's the right word, a huge part of the conversation going forward, was the demonstration before the game.
Yeah.
We saw players taking a knee, a moment there with Black Lives Matter at the center of the conversation. For the MLS, what is the conversation look like going forward and the action that's going to accompany it now that we're seeing this is going to be part of what we see during this tournament?
Well, you guys have heard me use the buzzword inclusive a ton, especially over the last, I'd say, 2.5 years since the men's national team failed to qualify for the World Cup. And this is what I'm talking about. You know, soccer is the most racist sport in the world, but it's not so apparent in the United States. And yet, there is a lack of black player in our country from the United States. And what I mean by that is there has been exponentially great players in this world. Thierry Henry is a manager for Montreal Impact, one of the top 25 to 30 best players ever in the world. And I spoke with him yesterday, and he just said, you tell me the next time the great black player immediately turns up in a front office, immediately turns up as a coach, immediately turns up in a power position in football, soccer around the world. And the answer is it doesn't. Now, for the United States, gentlemen, that's the real issue. When the sport is so expensive to play, it's very similar to baseball. And when you talk to anyone inside baseball that looks at the participation rates and what it is, it's too expensive now. And so now you lose those athletes. That's where soccer has to grow, because soccer around the world is the poor sport. That's what everyone plays. Yet here in the United States, soccer is actually the expensive sport. It really is an apples to oranges conversation. And when you change that, I firmly believe you will have the participation rate from black athletes that will go higher, because it's real money now in the league. You can make the same amount of money that you can in other sports. You can make it quicker, and you can play longer. So I just think at the younger rates, U.S. soccer has to do a much better job, and this is not a Major League Soccer issue. It's a culture issue. Soccer cannot be the most expensive sport. It goes against the grain of what the nature of the sport is. You need a ball, and you need a bunch of guys or girls to play. That's all you need. Guys, you can make a goal out of anything, and yet we're charging $2,500 to $3,500 a year, similar to baseball, and you're looking in the mirror saying, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense.
As always, follow him on Twitter, at Taylor Twellman. Man, you do such a spectacular job of covering the sport that you love. I love watching you do it and love listening to you doing it. Fun to have you back on TV, my friend. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah, good hearing your voice, boys.
Golic.
I tell you what, a great sports night last night, yeah. No doubt about it.
And Wingo.
What a day, what a show, what a time.
1, 2, 3, 4.
ESPN Major League Baseball senior writer Buster Olney joins us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Buster, good morning. Thanks so much for the time, my friend. You now that we've got 66 confirmed positive cases during the MLB intake period, you had the 5% prediction that we would get baseball. Where are you right now on positivity, Buster?
Yeah, and the way that I spend my days is to call around to different teams and say, how's it going for you guys? And at this point, I would put it at, to start the season, which would start 2 weeks from today, I'd put it at around 30 to 40%, and to get through the season, I still think 0%. It's interesting because clearly there are teams that have had real issues and canceled workouts, the Nationals, the Giants, the Athletics. Most of the teams I talk to are saying, you know what, it's going pretty well. Like, the testing results are coming back. We're getting our work in. Things are going okay. The ones that get the most attention, of course, are the teams that are having the issues.
And Buster, I guess to that extent, there's been so much that we plan for, and positive tests were one of those things that we certainly have become accustomed to as leagues return. As players have come back to facilities and teams have been together again, has there been anything that you've heard from there that surprised them about the process of coming back?
First off, they have been impressed with the level of how precise a lot of the health and safety protocol are within the team bubble, so to speak, or at the team site. And they have felt like that for the most part, they have taken it seriously. But, you know, the difference between Major League Baseball and the NBA or potentially the NHL is the fact that these guys aren't living in bubbles. And maybe a, you know, instructive situation that we could cite would be what happened with the Cleveland Indians. There's no team that has better leadership than the Indians, with Terry Francona, you know, Francisco Lindor, and they employed their players. Hey, remember your teammates and hold together. And then over the weekend, Franmil Reyes, one of their outfielders, was seen in social media at a July 4th party. And that is the fragility of this whole thing. As one staffer said to me, the whole thing is only as good as the weakest link. And the weakest links exist.
We're talking to ESPN Major League Baseball senior writer Buster Olney on Golic and Wingo. So, Buster, you've mentioned the word bubble a few times, and obviously we know that Major League Baseball is not putting everybody in one location, but you have 0% confidence we'll get through the entire season. Is there a plan B at some point for what they could do if this big outbreak forces them to try and look at some sort of bubble scenario?
No, I don't think there wouldn't be enough time. The practicality of it is that the calendar would run out for them to make an adjustment that big. Look, all these teams, when we talk about sites where they're playing, you know, they're building in safety nets, a B, a C, a D. You know, it wouldn't shock me at some point, for example, if you see a spike in numbers in one particular municipality, if a team winds up playing in a minor league park or shifting to another major league park. I think they're open-minded. But the fact is that, you know, the analogy I've used is that baseball is a rowboat in a hurricane. And I think to make that big of an adjustment, there just simply wouldn't be enough time for that.
Buster, you mentioned the strong leadership of teams and who people are looking towards. I'm curious right now, as we've heard some players talk about Mike Trout very, very publicly being one of them as a guy who's still unsure about his future, are there groups of players that Major League Baseball is still watching that worry could trigger a larger exodus?
And I think what happened with Freddie Freeman over the weekend was really, was telling. Where, you know, Freddie Freeman is as respected a player as there is in baseball. And so when word, you know, filtered out that not only had he tested positive, but he was sick and he had a spike in temperature. And Nick Markakis, his teammate, you know, as tough a player as there is in baseball, called him. And after that conversation and hearing how Freddie wasn't doing well, Nick Markakis decides to walk away. I think that the two players that people are watching in the game right now are Trout, and it wouldn't shock me if he were to walk away for at least a period of time because his wife Jessica is due to have their first child in early August. And Buster Posey is someone we're all watching. The Giants catcher, he's left the team for what has been said by Gabe Kapler, their manager, to be personal reasons. We heard Buster last week talk about, you know, being concerned. And the Giants are one of the teams that have had these issues with the testing. And let's face it, if Buster Posey walks away, it might make it more likely that other players will as well.
Buster, because of their age, managers are considered a higher risk than players. How comfortable are they being involved in this?
They're concerned. You know, one staffer that I know is at high risk. You know, his feeling is, look, I just can't imagine not being around it. You know, for that particular person, his feeling is, yes, I understand the risk, but I'm going to plow ahead and try to make it work. We've seen other coaches walk away. You know, people around the game have talked about Rocco Baldelli, the manager of the Twins, who has a difficult medical history, and they wondered how he's doing. It seems like they're all pushing ahead and trusting the health and safety protocol that the teams are employing. And as they say, that has been roundly praised by people I've talked to, how they feel like that the teams, the medical staffs within the bubbles, team facilities are actually being really diligent.
As always, great stuff. Buster Olney joined us. Buster, thanks so much. Stay safe, my friend. Thanks for hanging out with us.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Golic and Wingo.
Let's not expect too much. There's only one person out there that's expecting way too much out of this guy too early. We know who that is. It's his father.
So we're joined now by Elle Duncan, SportsCenter host. Also, you can hear her on The Intersection on ESPN Radio on Thursday nights. And Elle, for anybody that doesn't know or hasn't been listening to me on First Take, Your Take, I feel like over the course of the last couple of months in the world that we've been in, I've tried to lean on certain people that I just know are incredible, and their core is amazing and their heart is amazing, to help me get a better understanding and become a better person. Elle has been at or near the top of that list for me. So I love the fact that we can have this conversation with you, Elle, because it shook me yesterday to hear Steven Jackson's comments, because when you see somebody that has been trying to do so much good in the conversation about George Floyd come out and say something that just felt so awful and racist in its tone, it was jarring to me. What was your reaction?
Yeah, I well, thank you for what you said first, Fitz, and hey, Gojo, thanks for having me on. I was disappointed for the same reasons, you know, because not even trying to do good, he's done so much good, you know. He was sort of, you know, unwittingly pulled into this movement because it affected his friend, and he has risen to the occasion and become sort of this voice and vocal leader for one of the most, if not the most significant movement towards racial equality in our country. And it feels so sad. I'm just so disappointed. I'm disappointed because that legacy that he had created and built is so sullied now, because you cannot, in an effort to uplift your own community, just besmirch and dehumanize an entire other community. You know, it's incredibly dangerous. This rhetoric is so dangerous. There is a reason that anti-Semitic hate crimes are on the rise. There is a reason that hate crimes against Asian Americans are on the rise, against immigrants, against the LGBTQ community, against all these marginalized communities. And that's because we have allowed it for too long, and especially over the last few years, become so prevalent in our society. It's like, oh yeah, well, that was stupid, but we just keep it moving. And unfortunately, it's not that way for many people. Many people are emboldened by that kind of speech, and that then turns itself into hate. And whether that hate is relegated to just Twitter or not, I mean, we just had someone a couple of weeks ago arrested for trying to blow up, you know, a Jewish retirement community. Like, this is, it's incredibly dangerous and wrong. And I just, he should know better. He should know better, because he is fighting for his community. And to stand in the way, it's one thing to not be an ally, but to stand in the way of another community's fight for equality is just so off the mark.
And I think, Elle, that's worth noting too, is the platform matters in a lot of this. We just got done dealing also with Kelly Loeffler, part owner of the Atlanta Dream, coming out with a lot of very anti-Black Lives Matter comments in this one, as someone in a figure in the public who's going to influence a lot of other people and continue to add disinformation to a conversation that makes it all the more difficult in this one. But because Steven Jackson was someone we trusted so much in the other way, it's tough in all of this, Elle. And so, how much, you know, in the way of an ability for redemption should we levy in situations like this? How do we go about trying to allow someone that had built up so much goodwill to make this right in a way that could still have him as an ally going forward?
Yeah, listen, I am certainly one that has benefited from being given a second chance. I have made a very public miscue, and I was shown grace and humility. I was punished. You know, it wasn't as if I was allowed to skate by, and I still am reminded whenever someone disagrees with me of the mistake that I made, you know, 7 years ago. I'm not one to cancel people because I believe that when people show you that there is intentionality in their efforts and that they are, you know, fighting for certain causes, but also recognize their problematic thinking and recognize the need to change and are contritious. I have, you know, sort of yet to see that from Steven Jackson, which is what is disappointing. DeSean Jackson, listen, I was upset with DeSean Jackson because this idea that you were naive to what you were saying when something starts with, and as Hitler quoted, like, even if it was wrongly attributed to, you thought it was attributed to Hitler. We are all old enough at this point to know Hitler bad. I'm sorry. If you are saying, let this be a rule of thumb. If you are saying something that the neo-Nazis would applaud, it's wrong. And you cannot blame that on ignorance. I know what DeSean was trying to do. DeSean was trying to uplift the black community by saying we are God's chosen people and like we have been anointed, right? That's what he was trying to do. But again, the passage started with, and as Hitler quoted, and then completely dehumanized an entire group of people in the process. So I recognize that I think there was probably an ignorance to what some sects of the black Hebrew Israelite faction believe, right? There are certainly sectors that are not anti-Semitic, and there are certainly sectors that are anti-Semitic. So I think what he meant was he needed to do more research in terms of that movement and sort of the factions that are incredibly anti-Semitic and racist and the ones that are not. But you don't get an excuse for posting something that starts with Hitler. But Steven Jackson, I'm disappointed in because he doubled down. And I understand that he went on CNN, you know, yesterday and said that he used the wrong choice of words. But it still just, it still took a decidedly defensive tone. And I do think that he has done so much good for the black community. And now it's time for us. Listen, I have been asking of my friends, I have been asking of my colleagues and allies, and you all know this because you are friends, allies, and colleagues, to educate themselves, to read about the issues that affect the black community, to be vocal in our fight against anti-racism, right? How much have we been asking that of other people outside of our community? And at the very least, we can offer that same reciprocity. So it feels like to me, Steven Jackson has a very unique opportunity here to say, I was wrong. I don't know about the plight of the Jewish American community, and I'm going to spend the time unlearning what I have already learned and trying to figure out why this way of thinking is incredibly problematic. Because the things that he said about owning the banking system and the things that DeSean Jackson posted in that post about how, you know, Jewish people are in for world domination, but it won't be allowed if like black people just recognize, that is implicit bias, which is the exact same thing that affects black communities and is the charge of systemic racism and why we deal with police brutality and why women clutch their purse when a black man gets onto an elevator. Those things are all part of implicit bias. So I would hope he would recognize that the same things that he's calling out in regards to his own community are the same things that he's perpetuating against another community. And I think he has a chance to do that.
We're talking to Elle Duncan, SportsCenter host. You can hear her on The Intersection. Go look and Wingo on ESPN Radio, ESPN News. Elle, I consistently say smart people do dumb things sometimes. And, you know, there's this level of mistakes, and we see it right now. It's the tone of the conversation, I think, that is so difficult in the moment. How do we reach a spot where we can make people aware when their actions are hurtful and not react with such defensiveness? That's the portion of this that I can't find, because I think Mike pointed out earlier in the show, when you listen to the way Steven Jackson came back to apologize, it was done very defensively, as opposed to stepping up and just saying, my bad, I'm listening, I'm learning. So, like, where does that progression come from?
Yeah, I think it's a willingness to just be incredibly vulnerable and admit the fact that you don't have the answers, right? I mean, Lord knows that I'm certainly not perfect, and I try to sort of sit in my vulnerability and own it. I can't speak for other people, but I think that no one wants to be accused of being a racist, anti-Semitic monster. And I imagine that Steven Jackson's mentions don't look great right now. And so I think there is, in any way that you would be defensive about your own family members or about your own company or about your own team, there's probably, you know, a penchant to want to defend yourself and say, like, you don't know me and look at all the good that I've done for the black community. And like, you don't, I never said that I hated Jews, and I never said this, and I never said, it just becomes about all of the things that you didn't say. And you know, when you're cornered and you're feeling attacked, you want to fight back. Right. And that is a natural sort of thing, I think. But I think that in not just Stephen Jackson's case, but in most people's cases, you can say terrible things, and you can sort of find yourself in really tough situations, and they don't have to define you. And I don't think that this has to define Stephen Jackson or DeSean Jackson, but I think that in order to sort of move past this, they're going to have to get to a spot where they say, I messed up. I mean, there's no excuse for it, and I'm sorry. And I will spend, you know, my time while I have this platform trying to undo that wrong, and I hope that you will give me the ability to do it, but also recognize that you have now given people the leverage for the rest of your legacy to say, okay, well, he's done all this good, but he's also an anti-Semite, in the same way that I understand I gave leverage to the haters as well, that anytime someone, you know, finds me to you know, that anytime someone thinks that I'm taking the moral high ground, or anytime someone, you know, thinks that I'm on a soapbox, they'll conveniently remind me that there's a mugshot on the internet of me, right? Like, that is sort of where we're at. But I won't let it define me. And I don't argue with people anymore about it. And I don't try to defend my character anymore, because I put myself in that situation, you know, frankly. And I've learned from it, and I've grown from it. And I hope that he'll recognize the same thing. Like, who and the bad things that we do not define who we are. But you've got to start square one, just saying, I messed up, and I'm sorry, and I'm listening.
L. Duncan with us here on Golic and Wingo, and it is hilarious that the same people that would try and levy those slights at you or anyone else who's made a mistake were the same ones trying to point out Drew Brees' entire body of work to us in defense of someone who made a mistake on a particular issue right. Not too long ago. So the inconsistencies are not surprising in a lot right. of these spots. But
sure.
L., I did want to bring up something. We mentioned it before, but what's going on with Kelly Loeffler and the Atlanta Dream mm-hmm. and the WNBA? Obviously, all things at Atlanta are extremely near and dear to your heart. And this situation is such an interesting intersection of politics and sports at a time where the Black Lives Matter movement has become so central in the conversation around a lot of leagues, specifically the WNBA, that's always been at the forefront of all this. And you've got someone who is not, you know, one of the majority owners or day-to-day governors in the WNBA, but still around the team enough to draw a lot of reaction from the players inside of it. Do you think that Kathy Engelbert, the WNBA commissioner, and the rest of that league have a responsibility to look into, should this person be allowed to continue to partially own this team?
Absolutely. Because, listen, I keep saying this, like, idea about, well, I mean, so she's not allowed to be a conservative? She's not allowed. Of course she is. She's allowed to believe and think whatever she wants. She's allowed to appeal to her constituents, right? Which in Georgia are largely anti-LGBTQ. And she's allowed to think that, you know, black people that are legally armed to carry, because of course she also fights for the NRA and the right to carry. I was allowed to carry legally when I lived in Atlanta, as most people are afforded that right in Georgia. She can think that they are suddenly an angry mob but have nothing to say when it's white folks doing the same thing in Michigan. And she can believe that Black Lives Matter is a terrorist organization, but she should not then have the privilege of profiting off of those exact same groups that she would be working to oppress. That doesn't make any sense. This is a private organization, and it is a privilege to be an owner in the WNBA. And let me ask you this, gentlemen, if this was Donald Sterling's situation and Adam Silver would have said, well, he's really not involved in the day-to-day operations. So, I mean, we all assumed that. She's a senator. Like, she's working for the government. She's campaigning. She's campaigning for Trump. She's campaigning for herself. I assumed she wasn't in the offices every day making any type of personnel decisions. Would it have been enough for them to say, he's not in the building, guys? Like, it's, you know, it's fine, but still be able to profit off of those same black bodies that he would be looking to oppress? No, it's not enough. So she needs to go, period. She has offended the very groups of people that she would be working actively against. And the idea that she would own a team that is, you know, in a sport that is 80% black females, where there is a large population of women that identify as LGBTQ, and to actively be against both of those movements just seems so contrary to every, how disgusting would that be, right? Like, if you Gola Jr. worked for someone that was anti-donuts. Do you think that you could continue to do that, right? And that's something as simple as donuts.
So let me push.
That would be a tough existence.
Let me push back on this. Like, I want to pick your brain on it, Elle, because you know there's a spot here where I see from a player's standpoint, why would you want to sign with that organization as long as she's involved? Like, the players can take their own destiny into their own hands. Is it really fair though, as a company with the WNBA, to look at an owner and say, because your views don't align with ours as a company, we're not going to let you be a part of it? I mean, Donald Sterling and what he said was awful, and we all know that. What the senator has done is come out and made her views public on Black Lives Matter, which is there's sort of a difference in my mind. What am I not seeing?
What you're not seeing is the overtness, right? Like, Donald Sterling, I actually think it's worse in Loeffler's situation because she's very publicly, she knows what she's saying. Donald Sterling didn't know he was being taped, right? Like, which is disgusting in and of itself, but he didn't realize she is very outwardly and openly saying this so that she can appeal to her constituents, right? Like, the hot button issues that appeal to the conservatives in Georgia, or at least the ones that she's appealing to, which is, you know, I'm anti-rights for the gay community, and I think Black Lives Matter. It's like the same, you know, ridiculous tropes we keep hearing over and over. They're domestic terrorists, they're this and that, whatever. And so it's the overtness of Donald Sterling that was just really appalling. You know, when you hear someone say the things that he say, when you have him on tape, it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he would feel this way. But the exact thinking that Kelly Loeffler, this idea that she has, is again going back to that implicit bias. And the fact that's the stem of systemic racism, is thinking that Black people are somehow not afforded the same opportunities or abilities. She's never said anything about the Proud Boys. She's never said anything about, you know, the far right organizations that are actual and have actually been considered domestic terrorist organizations. She's never said anything about that. Meanwhile, she has something to say about Black Lives Matter. Meanwhile, she has something to say about, you know, legally armed Black people carrying in a state where it is allowed. She has nothing to say about that, but it's all good. You know, don't take my guns, and I'm pro NRA, unless it's Black people that have guns. And it's that kind of, not even microaggressions, that subtle racism that's just as problematic as the overt one. So that's the issue, is that she should not be allowed. Again, this is a private company. This is not a public owned company where, you know, where you're voted. This is not a democracy. You're not voted in. The women that play on that team didn't get to vote in who their owner is. Right. Like, we're sort of sitting in this in America right now because we've made the decision to elect these officials, and we have to sit in that. But those women didn't make that decision or that choice to be represented by Kelly Loeffler, period. And it's completely unfair. Freedom of speech does not mean freedom from consequence, in particular when you're talking about a private organization.
Elle Duncan with us here again. You can catch her always on SportsCenter as hosting The Intersection tonight on ESPN Radio alongside Clinton Yates. Elle, before we let you go, obviously a lot of this is very serious and worthwhile subject matter to discuss, but I also have something else. I tweeted at you about this the other day, and I need you to just paint people a picture in all of this. It is, you know, one of the happiest days of your life, maybe outside of the birth of your child. You are getting ready to marry the man of your dreams, your lovely husband, who I know and love dearly. And three songs into the experience, into your wedding, at the reception, Knuck If You Buck comes on. Please, God, put me in the moment that I wish I could have been a part of, and just paint the picture of that scene of pure joy.
It was so amazing because, like, you know, we come out, you know, it's like the introductions, and I come out to like an MGMT song or, you know, actually Empire of the Sun, right? Like, it's like synth pop, but that's what we come out to. And then me and Omar's first dance was to a Maxwell song called Lake by the Ocean. It's beautiful. And then right away, the DJ, who's a good friend of ours and, you know, bleeds ATL, plays Wicked by Future. And I was like, oh, we doing that already? Because the idea, guys, was to do a little like teaser set, right? Maybe like a 10-minute set, get everybody hype before we sat down and ate dinner and did the whole, you know, all the histrionics with the speeches and stuff. I wanted everyone to know what was coming after dinner. And so he goes right to Wicked, and I'm like, all right, so everybody loses it. And then he just immediately goes Knuck If You Buck. And I looked at him, and he was like, he just started smiling and nodding his head. And there's a video, I have to find it, that a friend took, and all you see is me in my wedding dress, and I spike, just like this, I spike my veil to the you, like it was... I spiked it. I was like, we're done. It was already like a mosh pit 10 minutes into my wedding, and it was incredible. It got to a point where my wedding planner comes over, and she's like, Elle, they want to serve salads, but no one will sit down. Can you please tell the DJ to stop? We didn't eat till 10:45. It was ridiculous. And it's funny. It's funny, Gojo, that you brought that up because that happened exactly 4 years ago today. Today is my anniversary.
Oh, look! Yeah. Look at God timing on that
look
one.
Look at what God did.
Oh, L.
Happy anniversary, L.
So you're about to have me fighting at 8:30 in the morning. Why would you play the song, y'all? Oh, my God.
I'm saying, like, you can't put Nuck If You Buck on and not expect people to just act absolutely foul with what happens next.
Yeah, we nucking and bucking and ready to fight. Come on! Already? Oh, no.
The visual in my mind of L just spiking her veil, like, that is stuck in my head for life at this point.
It was so good.
Oh.
All right, be sure to listen tonight to The Intersection on ESPN Radio. Of course, you can watch her on SportsCenter. L, we can't tell you enough how much we appreciate you getting up early and hanging out with us. Happy anniversary, my friend. Thank you so much for giving us some time today.
Hey, I love you guys. Anytime.
Golic and Wingo.
It was all sort of one big giant jello mold. Very interesting where that went.
Thankfully, Heather's here to save us.
I was proud of you. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN News. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike sitting with Mike Golic. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. Let's hop over to the Shell Penzo Performance Line, where we're joined by ESPN college football reporter Heather Dinich. Heather, we've had a lot of conversation this morning about, obviously, COVID-19 and what it means moving forward for everybody. We know at this point the Ivy League has the word was canceled around football. So the expectation is no college football season for the Ivy League. What was your reaction to that decision last night?
Well, I thought it was important to remember the reason they made that decision, which was campus policies. And that being some stringent policies that Robin Harris, the Ivy League executive director, made it impractical to have fall competition. She mentioned travel restrictions where they're coaches and student athletes can't go anywhere. There's also restrictions on visitors. There are stringent social distancing measures, and there's capacity limits for crowds of 25 to 50 people. So it's just impossible, literally, to have fall competition under those restrictions. That being said, every single university president throughout the country is probably paying attention to what the president at Harvard has to say about all of this. So while the Power Five commissioners hold the bulk of the power when it comes to decision-making process in college football, university presidents are key in all of this as to whether the season will happen at all and whether it will start on time.
So this is the first Division I conference to make this decision. But Heather, I'm curious, whether it's this or what we're seeing from Stanford, them cutting 11 varsity athletics programs after the 2020-2021 season, which of those, based on the reaction that you've heard, is the one that might be more concerning to other Power Five schools looking at these situations?
Well, I would think it would be the Ivy League situation because the Power Five conferences and everybody in the FBS, they might all ultimately reach that same conclusion just through their own paths, right? Stanford is unique because to start, it had an above average amount of sports. That's important to remember. So when you're talking about testing every single athlete in every sport that you have, Shane Lyons at West Virginia told me it's roughly estimated to be between $20,000 and $25,000, okay? So are you really going to want to, and no offense to the fencing program, but those are the ones that are on the line in terms of the budget cuts. And this isn't unique to Stanford. We're going to see more sports cut throughout the country. We're also seeing athletic departments at the highest level take pay cuts. Oklahoma just recently had its staff take 10% pay cuts for those who are making over $1 million, which was six people on that staff. So I do think that the Ivy League announcement will resonate, but I also do believe that there are going to be more athletic departments that have to cut their sports.
We're talking to ESPN college football reporter Heather Dinich. And Heather, I mean, maybe as a flaw, I focus too much on precedent. So what I keep seeing with the Ivy League is a precedent now where some very intelligent schools have looked at it and said it's not worth the risk. How concerned are other schools across the country about future liability legally when you've got a group of schools that have decided that they're not taking the risk, but other schools may decide to take that risk?
Sure. And again, that goes back to the university presidents. But liability is an important factor in all of this. You know, I talked with Robert Morris president Chris Howard. He was one of the college football playoff selection committees about that. And he said, look, we are doing everything we can and then some to follow CDC guidelines. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to protect us if kids are coming here and getting sick. So that's something university presidents everywhere are watching. And then if you want to take it a step further, what happens if there's a college football player with a pro career multi-million dollar chance at a future who contracts this virus? Then what do you do? And how does that play into the factor? So liability is certainly an issue at the highest level.
Heather, I'm curious. We heard from SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey last night addressing the topic of a spring season and not dismissing it, addressing it as if it was one of the options on the table. We had heard that months ago, but to hear it this close to the season, is that starting to be something that is gaining more traction as a realistic option in this, or still a worst-case scenario?
I don't believe it's gaining any more traction. Everybody that I've spoken with, from conference commissioners to athletic directors, has said, look, it's not our first option. It's not our second option. It's certainly doable, but there are so many problems with it that would have to be ironed out. I mean, I talked about the NFL draft, a concern there with the overlap, plus the possibility that big name players wouldn't play because of that. And then if you do have a spring season that's March, April, May, you're talking about training in January, February. And the reality of the situation is people are saying to me, look, we don't know that's going to be any better then than it is now. So there are a lot of concerns with that, but they are saying at some point we might have to dust it off.
Talking to ESPN college football reporter Heather Dinich. Greg Sankey, again, as Mike alluded to, saying that the Ivy League's decision doesn't really impact their decision. What does and when will they make it?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
What does impact their decision the most, and when do they expect to make a decision?
The most critical factors here are, one, are universities open? American Athletic Conference, Commissioner Mike Oresko told me, look, if students aren't on campus, all bets are off when it comes to college sports, right? But also, it's the coronavirus. That's the top decision maker. When you look at where the hot spots are, you can't throw a dart right now without hitting a Power 5 conference school. You're talking about California, Texas, Florida. All of those commissioners in those leagues are paying close attention to the numbers, and I can guarantee you, based on my conversation, there is much more pessimism around that than there was a couple of weeks ago. But the other thing that they're watching, guys, is what are our student athletes doing? They're on campus now for voluntary workouts, and they have gone to extreme lengths to protect them while they're in the athletic facilities. Everybody knew there was going to be positive tests, and then the question turns to what are they doing when they are away from the athletic facilities for whatever 22 hours it might be that they're not there. And athletic directors and commissioners are begging student athletes, wear a mask, social distance. Please take whatever precautions you can to protect yourself from this virus and the rest of your teammates. And that's why at Ohio State, you see things like the Buckeye Pledge that have surfaced, because Gene Smith there wants them to promise that they will do those things when they're not in the athletic facilities.
And well, Heather, to that point, Ohio State just announced that they're going to be shutting down their athletics program, their athletic workouts on campus for the next week. North Carolina had 37 positive tests and is doing the same thing. So are a lot of them looking, and this is coming off 4th of July weekend that a lot of people around college football thought would be a big test. Is this a failure of that test in the minds of a lot of people looking at this situation?
Well, you know, I mean, this is the thing, guys. They are college students. You know, somebody put this in a great perspective the other day when talking about just what a hot spot Austin is right now. And students aren't even on campus there, 50,000 students, right? It's in trouble without university students there. So, you know, I think in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter if the kids are going to their favorite bar or the taco bar. They have to figure out how to protect themselves. And I'll tell you, the two schools I know right now that I think are doing an excellent job of this, based on my conversation, are Navy, because you're talking about the military, that has actual capability to lock them down. It's called ROM, the ROM, restriction of movement. They are in the yard, they're getting tested, and they're not going to downtown Annapolis into the bar. So that's good for them. Notre Dame, which happens to be Navy's first opponent of the season and a very big game if it actually happens, has their athletes in a hotel, and they're doing the best that they can to entertain them there, keep them there, and create that sort of bubble you guys were talking about within Notre Dame athletics. So I'm talking to Jack Swerbrick later today. We'll see how that's working out for them. But there's only so much you can do to contain student athletes. And we're not even in that period where we're actually hitting preseason workouts yet. That's the key window in my mind.
Golic and Wingo.
Let's not expect too much. There's only one person out there that's expecting way too much out of this guy too early. We know who that is. It's his father.
The Ivy League Executive Director, Robin Harris, with us. Robin, we really appreciate the time. Obviously, you guys have been in the focal point of a lot of news in the sports world. So I'm curious. I'm sure this wasn't a decision you came to lightly. What was really the last thing that took this over the line where you looked at this situation and said, we can't go forward this fall?
Yeah, you're exactly right. This was not a decision made lightly, and it was one that was made actually very carefully. And it was the product of months of conversation among the Ivy League presidents about how their campuses are adjusting to the continued spread of the COVID-19 disease and how to properly and safely administer the campuses in the fall. And so as devastated as we are for our student athletes and our coaches, it became apparent as campus policies for students generally and for the campuses were finalized in the past several weeks that it was not going to be possible to have athletic competition this fall because the policies across the campuses, and they vary from campus to campus, but generally speaking, there are travel restrictions for faculty, staff, and students. There's limits on who can visit campuses, who can enter campus buildings. There are social distancing requirements, limits on the sizes of groups that can gather. Several of our campus right now have limits of 25 as the size of groups. And then we have a number of campuses who have significantly limited the number of students who are able to come back and be in residence on campus due to dormitory limitations and social distancing needs. So when you take all of that together, we treat our student athletes are students. Campus policies apply to intercollegiate athletics, and it became readily apparent that it was not feasible to be able that we weren't going to be able to hold athletic competition this fall. And it's a sad decision. It's one we didn't want to have to make, but it was very clear it was the right decision.
We're speaking with Ivy League Executive Director Robin Harris on Golic and Wingo. Jason Fitz in for Trey and Mike. So, Robin, how much consideration was given for football to moving it to the spring?
So no decision has been made on that yet. So that is an option that still exists for football as well as for the other fall sports. The presidents specifically indicated that there would be no competition at least through the end of the fall semester, and it is premature to make any decisions about winter or spring competition.
And with that in mind, January 1st was set at the date that no decision would be made before then. So as you continue to evaluate, are there certain markers that you guys will be looking for in order to decide, all right, it is safe to resume play in any of the sports, let alone the logistics of moving what we've had in the fall to later in the spring?
So a very minor point, we have not specified any date. One of the early stories that came out that was premature, was prior to our release, it had a January 1st date in it, and I don't know where that came from because we have no date specified. What we have said is there'll be no athletic competition through the fall semester, and fall semester then sometime in December, and sometime during prior to that time we'll have to make a decision about winter sports, and then at another time about spring sports. And frankly, you know, the situation with the virus has to change for us to be able to have competition. And we certainly hope that it does. And we hope that we are able to contain the virus. We hope that there's Our medical community is able to better treat the virus, particularly for those who get very sick and who, unfortunately, you know, we have the death rate is too high. And maybe at some point there will be a vaccine as well. But generally, we have to have better health and safety outcomes so that our campus policies change. And when that happens, then we would love to be able to have competition.
We're speaking to Ivy League Executive Director Robin Harris. Robin, would you then be comfortable having sports be played before a vaccine is out?
You know, I think it's going to be looking at the totality of the circumstances and what our campus policies end up being and what the state regulations as well. And so we have to get to a situation where the risk and the health and safety picture is just so much better than what it exists today. And, you know, a vaccine, people keep pointing to that, and that is ultimately the goal, right, to make sure that we can really protect the health and safety of campus communities and the population at large. I don't know that that's necessarily the only way that there would be competition.
Robin, in that regard, you guys have a lot of differences in the structure of sports in the Ivy Leagues as opposed to what we see in other forms in the larger Power Five conferences. But with that being said, with you guys and all the thought that's gone into this decision making, has there been any communication from some of the Power Five schools, other Division One presidents, you know, conferences with you in regards to how you guys got this decision?
So it hasn't been that long, but as commissioners, we have been meeting regularly by video call for several months now. We exchange information, and I think what's important here is we made a decision for the Ivy League. Our presidents made this decision based on Ivy League campus policies, and it's absolutely the right decision for the Ivy League, and different conferences and different schools are going to have to look at their own policies and their own considerations to decide how best to proceed.
Robin, were there particular people within the medical community that you guys leaned on to get information as you made these decisions?
That's a good question because that came up a lot in March as well. So our presidents have each incredible resources that they rely on in setting their campus policies. We have obviously university hospitals, medical schools, epidemiologists, infectious disease specialists on our campuses, and our presidents tap into those individuals as well as other experts, whether they're alumni, governmental experts, and that informs the campus policies, and then as a result, that has a direct impact on our athletics policies. So, for example, our presidents have said that athletics activities can occur on campus for student athletes who are enrolled this fall in a phased-in and safe manner and subject to campus policy. And what that means is our student athletes and coaches will be able to have modified practice opportunities throughout the fall as they are deemed to be safe by the campuses.
And Robin, just to be clear, because you've brought up some notes in here about some of the reporting and clarifying some things for us, I just want to also be clear that you guys have stated relative to the contracts of the coaches involved in these situations, relative to, and really for me, the eligibility of the student athletes. Will there be a preservation of that year of eligibility for the student athletes affected by this in the fall?
Yeah, so for fall sport athletes in particular, because they will not be having competition this fall, they will not lose a season of eligibility, even if they practice.
Awesome. That's great to know. Just wanted to clarify that in the interest of making sure we've got all of this nailed down in a lot of this. Robin, thank you so much for all of the information on this. Obviously, a difficult decision, as you said, but one you guys clearly put a ton of thought and time into. So thank you for the time, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you so much, and hopefully next time when I talk to you all, it can be about a much happier topic.
Absolutely. We are all hoping that. Amen to that.
This has been the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or just ask your smart speaker to play Golic and Wingo. Plus, you can check the guys out live weekday mornings from 6 to 10 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN News.